From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jay Baker, the son of former televangelist Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. He has his own ministry now, serving the kind of kid he once was, disillusioned and self-destructive. We'll talk with him about his work and about what it was like to grow up on Christian TV while living in his parents' theme park, Heritage USA. Jay Baker has a new memoir. Also, we remember Leo Marx, who died last month. He wrote the screenplay for Peeping Tom, one of Martin Scorsese's favorite movies, helped the British sabotage the Nazis in World War II, and grew up in his parents' famous London bookstore at 84 Charing Cross Road. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. John Ashcroft was confirmed as the nation's next attorney general today as a divided Senate gave its approval, largely along party lines. 42 Democrats voted against Ashcroft. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Democrats called it a shot across the bow, allowing President Bush to have his cabinet, but signaling tougher fights to come if he sends more divisive nominees to Capitol Hill. Republicans called it a big win and said Ashcroft prevailed despite unfair attacks from the left. Texas Republican Phil Graham predicted that the bruising confirmation battle wouldn't deter Ashcroft.
I'm beginning to wonder if this was all an effort to smear and defeat John Ashcroft, or whether this was an effort to cow John Ashcroft.
Graham said either way, the effort was not a success. Majority Leader Trent Lott also complained about the rhetoric, but urged his colleagues to put the fight behind them and get back to the spirit of bipartisanship that marked most of the other confirmation votes. Both parties are holding retreats to discuss their legislative strategies. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that the new administration intends to keep pressure on Iraq until it eliminates its weapons of mass destruction. Powell told reporters that Iraq is trying to develop weapons of mass destruction to make up for its limited conventional weapons. The former general said Saddam Hussein's regime is a threat to the children of the region. Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Gulf War. California lawmakers have approved a $10 billion power buying bill designed to ease the nation's electricity crisis. Scott Horsley reports from member station KPBS.
The measure allows the state government to buy electricity under long-term contracts lasting up to 10 years. That power will then be resold to customers of the state's financially stressed utilities. Those utilities have been squeezed by wholesale power prices that have soared far above the retail rates they're allowed to charge consumers. On an earlier vote, the bill failed to win a needed two-thirds majority, but it passed on a second try when several lawmakers changed their minds. The bill's sponsor had warned his colleagues if they failed to act, two big utilities would go bankrupt. Earlier in the day, Pacific Gas and Electric had defaulted on loans worth nearly $750 million. PG&E says it will pay only a portion of the money it owes to its suppliers. For NPR News, I'm Scott Horsley in San Diego.
That bill has now been signed by California Governor Gray Davis. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has given up on the possibility of a summit meeting with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat before next Tuesday's election. Barak's decision came after two Israelis and two Palestinians were killed in violence today. Some observers said a summit with Arafat might have improved Barak's chances against his right-wing opponent Ariel Sharon. In stocks today, the Dow gained 96 points to close at 10,983. This is NPR News. A grand jury in Dallas has issued murder indictments against six men who escaped last month from a Texas prison. The men were recaptured in Colorado after 6 weeks on the run. They're accused of killing a policeman during the robbery of a Dallas-area sporting goods store on Christmas Eve. The man accused of leading the convict group, George Rivas, arrived in Dallas today after being extradited from Colorado. The World Health Organization is appealing for $2 million to examine the possible health effects from depleted uranium munitions used in the Balkans and during the Gulf War. The WHO says it will need a total of $20 million to conduct scientific studies over the next 4 years. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
WHO notes there's widespread speculation that depleted uranium weapons used in the Balkans and Gulf conflicts may be responsible for cancers such as leukemia. WHO expert Xavier Leus says only in-depth scientific studies will lay to rest the concerns and uncertainties surrounding the possible health risks.
In this, for the sense that there might be possible consequences, environmental health consequences, environmental health risk factors occurring in the theaters of conflict, which possibly have nothing to do with depleted uranium.
Money from the appeal will be used over the next 6 months to conduct epidemiological studies, improve data collection and registries of cancer and other diseases in the Balkans, Iraq, and other Gulf states. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
In stocks today, the technology-weighted NASDAQ Composite Index gained 10 points to close at 2,783. The broader S&P 500 gained 7 points to close at 1,373. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jay Baker, describes himself as having been born into the premier family of a mega media church, a family that many viewers once assumed was the perfect Christian family. Jay is the son of televangelists Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. They were the creators of the 700 Club and the PTL Club, which was broadcast through their own Christian satellite network. PTL stood for Praise the Lord. Two scandals brought down this television ministry in the late 80s. Jim Baker was accused by Jessica Hahn of raping her, a charge he has denied, although he admitted to a sexual encounter. Jim Baker was also convicted of defrauding the followers of PTL. Meanwhile, Jay Baker went through a rebellious period. He dropped out of high school, drank, smoked marijuana, and used LSD. But now he has his own ministry. He's working with young people who are alienated and rebellious, including kids into hardcore music, goth, and skateboarding. His ministry is called Revolution. He's written a new memoir called Son of a Preacher Man. I asked him why he identifies with the young people he ministers to.
Growing up, I was always a skateboarder, and then when we lost PTL, my dad went to prison, and I got into high school, I kind of changed my whole image. I became like this preppy kid, but I was going through so much, and the kids that really embraced me were the punks and the goth kids and, you know, those different types, the subculture of the high school, and I don't know. There was just something about it that it felt like right. It felt like me. It felt like where I belonged. And so I just became part of the group.
Now, part of what you do in your ministry is you have a lot of bands perform.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the music.
We have all sorts of different music. We have Christian music. We have non-Christian music. We have hardcore music, which is basically screaming and very loud guitars and drums. We have melodic punk. We even have the Huntingtons, who sound just like the Ramones. Matter of fact, when they're in New York, they play with the Ramones. We have the X-Impossibles, who the guitarist owns one of the local tattoo parlors. We just had Gargantua, who's another guitarist who owns a tattoo parlor in town. So we have all different types of bands, that different genres of music and different faiths, different beliefs. We even have atheist bands play.
What kind of reaction do the bands that play at the things that you stage with your ministry get from other Christian groups?
Everybody's pretty open about it. I think one of the worst things we ever happened was is we have a lot of atheist kids come when we do hardcore shows. And, I mean, there's a huge hardcore scene where you're at in Philadelphia. But we had a show, and I went up to the band and said, listen, you know, I heard the band was being a Christian band. They were being real zealous. They're like, oh, there's atheists here tonight. We have to be ministers. We have to blah, blah, blah. We have to really put it in their face. And I went up to them and said, listen, you guys, you know, please don't get preachy. Please don't get crazy. Please don't get in their face. I said, we've built, you know, years building relationships with these people. You know, these people are hurt enough and have had enough stuff shoved down their throat. Please don't do anything. And the kid looked at me and goes, well, I would be willing to die for my God, you know, and just had this really militant attitude. And I said, well, listen, I said, I've worked very hard not to have this ministry be that kind of ministry. And he said, okay. Next thing I know, they went on, you know, they broke into a praise and worship song, Our God is an Awesome God, hardcore version, and started saying, you're in church, welcome to church. And so I have a harder time with some of the Christian bands rather than the non-Christian bands, actually.
Are some of the bands that play for the concerts that your ministry gives banned from other ministries? Do you find that other ministries are as open musically as you are?
No, most aren't. Most are Christian entertainment facilities, and we are not. That's not what we're called to do. We're called to just give people a safe environment to hang out and just let people relax and be who they are and come as they are. I feel like that's what Jesus would be doing. That's where Christ would be. I think if Jesus managed a club, that's the type of club he would manage.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jay Baker. He's the son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and the author of the new book, Son of a Preacher Man, My Search for Grace in the Shadows. Jay Baker is a minister himself now. I wonder if you think that certain Christian groups and churches do foolish things in the way that they try to get teenagers to stop listening to hardcore or heavy metal or any other form of music that they consider to be anti-Christian or a bad influence.
Well, I think the 80s was the most ridiculous when they were backward masking, and then they'd have these, they still have these big events where they tell the kids, they like, bring your CDs. They call them secular CDs, and we're going to break them and burn them and give them to God. And, you know, I think that's kind of out of touch. I mean, I think if a kid is listening to an album and he feels like it's not good for him and that it's bringing him down, then he shouldn't listen to the album. But if an album's not bothering him, I don't see a problem with it. I think it's kind of pathetic and manipulative how the church has reacted to non-Christian music. We've tried to scare kids. We've been like, the devil's in your music. They're going to make you kill yourself, or different things like that. And I just think that's foolish nonsense.
Do you think that devil imagery is particularly potent for kids who grew up in fundamentalist families, who grew up quite literally believing in the devil?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of these kids, if you asked them, you know, if they gave you a true, honest answer, why are you serving God? These kids that were raised that way, because I'm scared of going to hell. Because I'm afraid of burning to death. Why don't you do this or do that? Because I'm scared of the devil, or I'm scared what God might do to me. And they have this complete misconception of who Christ is and who God truly is, because they've had so much religious tradition shoved down their throats that it's really not biblical at all, or it really doesn't have anything to do with Christ at all. I mean, Christ was a friend to sinners. Christ never used perfect people. But somehow we've gotten to the point where we believe that somewhere along the lines that changed. After the Bible was written, now all of a sudden God uses perfect people. And that's impossible. There are no perfect people.
How do you deal with teenagers who are behaving self-destructively or who are being dangerous to others? And, well, for instance, like kids who are really becoming addicted to drugs or alcohol, or who are being very racist or violent.
Well, I'm in a 12-step program myself, so when I'm dealing with kids who have addictions, you know, I try to help them get involved in a 12-step program. I talk to them, but I try to leave the decision up to them. I'm not at the point where I'm like, you're going to have to do this, you have to do that. I can't change their minds. When kids are becoming violent or different things like that, I remember one kid in particular who just was who was a skinhead, and he just was so angry all the time and so mad, and I just said, you know, he's going down the wrong path. I asked him, I said, hey, man, let's go eat lunch. And we had lunch together, and I said, listen, you know, I feel that you're acting like an idiot, you know, that you're talking about harming people. You seem like you're becoming racist. I'm like, what's going on? You know, and just confronting the issue and saying, listen, man, I love you, and this is why we're talking. This is why I'm saying what I'm saying. Because I don't want to see you go down this path, because I've seen so many kids before do this, and it leads to nowhere fast. And if a kid is cutting themselves or different things like that, we'll talk to them for a while, and eventually we get them into counseling. I'm glad to say we pretty much have 100% success rate in the area with kids who have been cutting themselves or mutilating themselves. We've been able to get them into some sort of counseling, and now they're no longer doing that. So we've really been successful in that area.
Now, what music and movies meant the most to you as a kid?
Interesting question. I think U2 Joshua Tree when I was 11 meant a lot to me. It was just a really special album. It was kind of, I had listened to rock and roll and stuff before, but for some reason that album just really pierced my heart in a special way. And I love Star Wars and Indiana Jones, and I still collect Han Solo action figures. Most people collect Star Wars stuff. I only collect Han Solo figures or maybe a Chewbacca figure here or there. But that's the kind of stuff that was special to me when I was young.
Now, did your parents try to restrict what you watched and what you listened to?
No.
I mean, they were on TV all the time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But they were quite open. I can remember when everybody was saying, I don't know if you remember a rock band called Striper back in the 80s, Christian rock band, and they were pretty popular. They were on TV and different things like that. And all the Christians were saying, these guys are satanic, and they're trying to infiltrate the church and all this stuff. And they were playing at a local bar in town. And I asked my dad, I said, I really want to go see this band Striper. And my dad said, okay, you can go see him, but you got to go with me. And so actually him and my mom and my sister, we all went to this bar, you know, sticking out like a sore thumb. They finally put us up stairs in like a private room. But it was this little bar in the middle of nowhere. The first band was like this complete, like, supposedly satanic band. It was like crazy. But my mom and dad took me to see Striper. And at the end of the show, my folks invited Striper to come and stay at Heritage USA at one of the hotels. And it's kind of funny. I guess that's where I got my start. You know, my dad was very open to all types of music and all types of ministry. My dad was never closed-minded to anything.
My guest is Jay Baker. His new memoir is called Son of a Preacher Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jay Baker is my guest, and his new book is called Son of a Preacher Man, and he's the son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and now has a ministry of his own. Now, you say in your book, I started life on Christian TV. Did you like being on TV?
No, I didn't. It wasn't my favorite thing in the world. I don't know why I didn't like it. I think one reason, I was a heavy-set young man, and I didn't like seeing myself on television, and I wanted to play. I mean, I can remember putting my jeans and my T-shirt underneath, like, my suit or whatever outfit that I had on. And as soon as the show was over, I would split. And see, the show was from, like, 11 to 12. And so I would leave school and come to the show. But whenever we had the show, I would never go back to school. I would talk my security guard into not making me go back to school, and I'd take the whole day off, which I'm sure my dad wasn't very happy about, or my mom.
So were you forced to be, like, a goody-goody in your public life?
Not by my family. I think some of the partners wanted it that way. I can remember a particular situation where I was wearing a T-shirt that one of the partners found offensive. And when they reported it to the security, security came to me and took me to my dad. And my dad said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I like my shirt. And he said, okay, well, if you like your shirt, then wear your shirt. And he was real. He loved the partners to death, but he was very particular to make sure that they didn't raise us. You know, that public opinion didn't raise us, that him and mom raised us.
I thought it's funny, you know, in your book you say during part of this period when you were, you know, growing up in the limelight, you really wanted to be Don Johnson on Miami Vice, and you and your friends would fake drug deals with Ziploc bags filled with flour.
That was really funny. It was fun. I always dressed up. I always was somebody else. I always took my playtime to the extreme. I mean, if I was an army man, I was in complete camouflage and had black makeup on my face and a machine gun. Or if I was Don Johnson, I had a pink shirt on and a white jacket and a silver 45 with a shoulder holster.
Now, you grew up in your parents' theme park. You were 5 when it opened to the public. This is Heritage USA.
Yeah, and Heritage USA really wasn't a theme park.
Why don't you describe it? Yeah,
it was more of a retreat. We had unwed mothers' homes. We had homeless centers there. We had marriage counseling, drug counseling. I mean, they had, I can't even remember how many services they had a week, but, you know, 24-hour church services. And my dad, right before the end of PTL, decided to build a water park to give the kids something to do. And when he built the water park, I think that's where everybody got the idea that it was a theme park. It really wasn't. It was a water park with a little miniature train that went around this water park, because all PTL was really a retreat to come get ministered to and do different things. And it had a roller skating rink, but the kids really didn't have anything to do. So my dad put the roller skating rink in, put, you know, a water park in, and that was something for the young people to do so the parents could come, drop their kids off, know their kids were safe, and get ministered to or do whatever they want, relax, take a walk, you know. But it by no means was it Disneyland or Disney World, even though it was the third most visited park in the country. It wasn't really a theme park. There was no, like, Noah's Wild Rapids or anything like that.
Were you a believer as a kid? I'm wondering what your concept of God was and of the devil.
I thought that the devil was hell, fire, and brimstone, and God was the person who told me I better be good and who made me and created me. And that was kind of my concept of who God was. I knew God loved people very much because I knew my parents loved people very much, and I knew that my parents were wanting to be imitators of Christ and imitators of God, and they were always reaching out to people, even beyond the spotlight and the cameras. I mean, I remember spending I remember spending Christmases with homeless families with no cameras or nothing around and bringing them presents. You know, my parents just always really truly loved people. I mean, we were the first big ministry to reach out to AIDS patients and the homosexual community. And we were open to that. And there was a lot of unconditional love at Heritage USA. And so that was kind of a new thing.
Were your parents strict with you? Were there a lot of rules you were supposed to follow?
No, as long as I wasn't, like, threatening my safety, I was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I left the house and they didn't know where I was at, I usually got a spanking. One time, my friends wanted to go motorcycle riding, and so I just got up out of bed, and my parents were still asleep, and I went with my friends motorcycle riding, and I remember my dad's car driving up, and he made me pick a switch, and he spanked me. There was one time I spit in somebody's face and he spanked me. So, you know, it was basically if I disrespected people or if, you know, got myself in danger. But, you know, my parents weren't super strict. No, they were very open to me being my own person and making my own decisions.
At what point did you start rebelling?
I think I started to rebel right after we lost Heritage USA.
And that was in 1987?
That was 1987, and I was 12, 13. I started to mess around with cigarettes a little bit and drink a little bit and go out and hang out with my friends.
And 1987 was the year that your father was accused of 24 counts of mail fraud and wire fraud.
I think that was in 88, and then in 88 is when he went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, yes. 88 is when he went into prison. 87 is when we lost Heritage USA.
And you lost it because of these charges?
No. We lost Heritage USA because Jerry Falwell came and said there's a scandal going to come out about Jessica Hahn. And what I want you to do is I want you to turn PTL over to me for 6 weeks to 6 months at the most and let me run it, and then we'll restore you and return you back to Heritage USA and everything will be fine and everything will blow over. But if you don't turn it over to me, he said, Jimmy Swaggart is going to try to destroy you. So my dad signed PTL over to Jerry Falwell. Well, within 24 hours, Jerry Falwell was, you know, calling my father homosexual, you know, saying he was greedy, you know, and within 24 hours, my father realized he had been had and his ministry had been stolen from him underneath his feet.
And you mentioned...
And then that's when the government came in after that.
And you mentioned the Jessica Hahn scandal.
Yes.
She was a woman who... Well, she charged that your father had tried to rape her, I think, in a hotel room.
Right, but that never stood up in any court anywhere. You know, this was 7 years prior to 1987, And my mother had left my father, and my dad was being pretty stupid, actually, trying to make my mom jealous. And one of his friends said, "Oh, I know this girl named Jessica Hahn. I want to set you up with her and introduce you to her." And he did, and they had a 20-minute sexual encounter. And that was the last he saw of Jessica Hahn until she started coming around in 1986. But my dad didn't know about it really until 1987, until Jerry Falwell said something, because she was talking to assistant pastors and different people like that who were not communicating with my father what was going on.
So this is the period when you started rebelling?
I just rebelled during that time because everything was gone. I was so hurt. I was so wounded. I was really destroyed by the loss of PTL because I lost a lot of friends. And all of the church just disappeared. All the people that my family had helped and worked with in the different ministries all just kind of just took off and either acted like we didn't exist or preached against us. And it was a really horrible, hard time. Of course, Saturday Night Live every weekend was making jokes and different things like that. So for a 12, 13-year-old kid, growing up, that was a very hard thing to grasp and handle because everything I knew was gone. And then, you know, within a year, my father was on trial, and then he went to prison.
Do you think it made it harder for your parents with you doing drugs and drinking and stuff like that? Like, you're supposed to be a model kid, and, you know, what kind of Christian parents are they if their son is running wild like this?
Well, no, I don't think so, because I didn't start doing drugs until Dad got into prison, and they didn't know about the drinking until Dad got into prison.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they're like, "Oh, we're supposed to be model Christians and our kids aren't acting up." I mean, we were a devastated family. We were torn apart. Everything we knew was gone, and we were shell-shocked. So, you know, my parents weren't worried about, you know, how they were looking at that moment. You know, we looked, you know, pretty much to the public eye, we looked like crap. You know, no one wanted to have anything to do with us. We were the scum of the scum at that time, and that's what the church considered us, and that's what the world considered us. And it was a very, very dark time.
Jay Baker has written a new memoir called Son of a Preacher Man. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jay Baker talks about his relationship with his parents, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Also, we remember Leo Marx, who died last month. He wrote the screenplay for Peeping Tom, helped the British sabotage the Nazis in World War II, and grew up in his parents' famous London bookshop at 84 Charing Cross Road.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jay Baker. He's the son of former televangelist Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, the creators of the 700 Club and the PTL Club. Jay has his own ministry now, working with disillusioned young people. He's written a memoir called Son of a Preacher Man. How do you think your sense of being a Christian compares with your parents?
I don't know. I think basically me and my parents and my sister are very, very close in our beliefs because we love people completely and we love people unconditionally. And because we're humans, we've made mistakes and we realize that no one's perfect. All have sinned, all have fallen short of God's glorious standard or whatever it says in the Bible. And so we just love people and let people realize that God loves you unconditionally is our message.
A lot of the fundamentalists and televangelists, such as Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, have been very aligned with the political right and
right.
With anti-feminism, anti-abortion, anti-gay politics. And I'm wondering where you put yourself politically.
I don't usually answer political questions, but I don't think religion and politics really need to mix. Personally, I don't believe that my convictions need to be put laws on people's bodies or minds or ideas. So I try not to mix the two. I'm not into things like the Christian Coalition and different things like that because, you know, they may be Christians, but they're definitely not my coalition and they don't represent me as a Christian. And I don't know. I don't think politics have a place or Christianity has a place in politics or politics a place in Christianity. But a lot of people would disagree with me on that. And a lot of people would say, you know, I hate you because of that. But that's just the facts. I think we need to keep our faith more of a one-on-one thing with Christ rather than having it involved in our government.
It sounds like you still love your parents very much. They're divorced. Your mother's remarried. I'm wondering if they're on good terms with each other.
Yeah, they are. We just did Larry King together recently, and you know, it was cool. They were fine. You know, I mean, you know, they're divorced. You know, they're both remarried, so you know, they're not like hanging out and going to have dinner together or anything like that. But they're definitely civil to one another.
What are your parents, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, doing now?
My dad runs a ministry down in Florida where he runs a restoration center for hurting pastors, and he works with inner-city youth. Actually, some of the kids that I've had to deal with who suffer from drug addiction and different things like that, I've sent down there to get help. And my mom is about to do a cartoon on Nickelodeon, and I think she's about to write another book. And so that's all I know what's going on with them right now.
I know in the documentary about her, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, she went for a makeover, and they were getting rid of like this cool black leather jacket and tight pants, mm-hmm. and she hated the look and said it really wasn't her. You know, maybe it was very hip, but it wasn't her, and she went back to the big hair and the eye makeup and the whole bit. What's her look now?
Same thing. You know, I think she's gotten away from she got away from the big hair in the 1980s. She has really no hair. Barely at all. She has very, very short hair. She wears wigs and she wears her makeup. She's who she is. It was funny, the other day I was riding in a car with a kid from a punk band, and he goes, "I just got one question, Jay." And I was like, "Well, what is it?" And he goes, "Why does your mom wear all that makeup?" And I'm sitting here looking at him at this covered in tattoos, hair greased back, you know, looks like he stepped out of a, you know, 1950s movie, you know, biker movie. Thinking, you know, what do you mean? what's about? You know, that's what she likes. That's her preference. That's her style. And she's got to be her. She's more original than me with my tattoos. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people with tattoos. You know, I get persecuted because I have my tattoos, but there's a large group that doesn't persecute me. Almost everyone's persecuted my mother for her makeup, and she doesn't care. And that's what I love about my mom. Is she's like, you know what? This is what I'm comfortable in. This is me, and this is who I am. Take it or leave it. And she's very inspiring. She inspires, you know, she inspires the hell out of me.
You know, you say in your book that when you were going through your goth period, I think this is in your book, it might have been in an interview that you gave, but anyways, you said when you were going through your goth period, you used to use some of your mother's makeup.
That was actually a Rolling Stone interview.
Yeah,
I never really
right.
went through I never really went through a goth period or time. It was when I would go out to a goth club called I think it was called Visage in Orlando, and you know, I'd put on black eyeliner, you know, and try to act all scary.
did your mother know that you were using her makeup?
Oh yeah, she thought it was funny. She thought it was like Halloween.
So she liked that. She's so into makeup that she liked the idea.
Oh yeah, you know, she's just like, you know, kids are crazy, teenagers are weird. This is the kind of stuff they do. So whatever.
Right. Do you still ever have impulses that scare you?
Yes, oh, of course, all the time. You know, I mean, writing this book, there were many times I wanted to drink. My wife had to talk me out of going to a bar once. I walked out of the middle of Bible study, and all the kids thought I was sick. And the next week I went into Bible study, and I said, hey, you know, I left Bible study last week to go have a drink, but I didn't have it. And I try to be honest as possible with my kids. My kids, they're not, half of them are older than me. But the people at Revolution about, you know, hey, I'm struggling. I still have ideas and thoughts and ideas that scare me. You know, I still have temptations in my life, and I try to be as transparent as possible so they never think that I'm any better than them or that they have to live up to some expectation, because it's, you know, I think religion has put too many impossible expectations on people as it is, and that just destroys peace and serenity altogether.
Well, Jay Baker, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you, Terry.
Jay Baker has written a new memoir called Son of a Preacher Man. Coming up, we remember a man who made his mark in the worlds of movies, books, and sabotage. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember Leo Marx, who died in mid-January at the age of 80. He grew up in his parents' famous antiquarian bookstore at 84 Charing Cross Road in London, a bookstore that was at the center of the movie and memoir 84 Charing Cross Road. In the film world, he's best known as the screenwriter of the 1960 movie Peeping Tom, one of Martin Scorsese's favorites. Marx was also one of the British Army's top code makers in World War II. He was the director of codes for the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which was charged with sending agents to infiltrate enemy-occupied territory in preparation for D-Day. When I spoke with Marx in 1999, after the publication of his memoir, he told me that when he entered the military, agents' secret messages were encoded into poems. Some agents preferred to use poems by famous writers. Others used poems that were written for them. Although Marx thought the poem code was vulnerable and eventually replaced it, he wrote a now famous poem that was used as a code. I asked him to read it.
The life that I have is all that I have, and the life that I have is yours. The love that I have of the life that I have is yours and yours and yours. A sleep I shall have, a rest I shall have. Yet death will be but a pause for the peace of my years in the long green grass will be yours and yours and yours.
Now, how was a code passed along in a poem?
An agent would be given a poem. And it would vary in length, and he'd choose five words from that poem. He'd show us by an indicator system which five words they were, and then he'd give each letter of those words a number, and then jumble up the letters of his message and send them to us in a jumbled order. But if the Germans intercepted that message and broke it, they could mathematically reconstruct the five words of the poem which he'd used. And if he'd used a famous poem, as one poor devil did, God Save the King, the Germans would know the rest of the poem, and they needn't break any more messages in order to read his back traffic. So, whilst trying to change the entire system, I made a rule that as many poems as possible should be original compositions, so that at least if the Germans broke a message, we'd hold them up a little, because they wouldn't know the rest of the words.
Is there a story that you had always wanted to share, but you didn't feel at liberty to until now?
Yes, many. The most important of all, I was finally able to share in this book. And it's about a brilliant, brilliant general of ours called Templar. Because a lot of people think that Britain doesn't take many major liberties in war and stick strictly to the rules. This man was a rule breaker, and he wanted to give the impression of a German resistance movement in Germany where none existed. And he instructed me to devise a code book that could be found in Germany to suggest that we had an active resistance movement there. What he didn't tell me till much later was that the code book was to be found on the body of a dead double German agent who would be killed whilst parachuting, and that I would have to brief this man with complete sincerity before he left. That was one of the major deception operations in the war. And strangely, a lot of people have doubted it and said Britain would never do that. Well, I received a letter just about 3 months ago from someone who'd read the book and was delighted to say he was the man instructed by General Templar to mount this operation by devising a parachute that would not open. And he then had to report to the general, "Sir, this can't be done. They detect something wrong." And the general cut him short and said the whole thing's been stopped because it's against the policy of prisoners of war. It has been a relief to tell that. I disliked briefing a man who was going to be killed.
Code making seems like the perfect job for you since you were brought up appreciating language. Your father owned Marks & Company, the famous antiquarian bookstore at 84 Charing Cross Road in London, the bookstore that was the subject of a book and a subsequent film adaptation. Would you describe the store?
I never learned language except the language of the cash register. It was a highly commercial business. And I was the only son of two partners, Marks and Cohen, who thought it would be better to call it Marks and Co. than Marks and Cohen. And Dad had decided 3 months before I was born.
Was that for anti-Semitic reasons? I mean, for fear of anti-Semitism?
Anti-Semitism and general style. They thought Marks and Co. sounded better. Yes, fundamentally anti-Semitism. But it was B. Marks and M. Cohen. Mm. And every Saturday morning at the age of 8, I was taken into that store and instructed in the price of books. Nothing to do with the content or the quality, just the price.
Now, you write in your memoir that your favorite section of your father's bookstore was the occult section. Why were you interested in the occult?
Fundamentally, because it helps when you're breaking codes if you become interested in unconscious communication. You believe in it or you don't. You think you can pick up thoughts that other people are not expressing, and possibly they yours. And I learned a form of two-way communication in 84 Charing Cross Road that was years later to be invaluable in SOE when we were fighting to win the war of the resistance movement codes.
We're listening back to a 1999 interview with Leo Marx, who died in January. He wrote the screenplay for the 1960 British film Peeping Tom, one of Martin Scorsese's favorite movies. Peeping Tom is about a young man who makes his living taking girly photos to be sold under the counter, but his real obsession is making movies of women as he murders them. The young man is a victim of the experiments his scientist father did on him as a child.
He wanted a record of a growing child. Complete. In every detail. Such a thing were possible. And he tried to make it possible by training a camera on me at all times. I never knew the whole of my childhood one moment's privacy. He was interested in the reactions of the nervous system to fear.
Fear?
Fear. Especially fear in children and how they react to it. I think he learned a lot from me. I'd wake up sometimes screaming. He'd be there, taking notes and pictures. And I'm sure good came of it for some people.
Peeping Tom was conceived whilst briefing agents in Baker Street because I was convinced that cryptographers, code makers, are, in their way, voyeurs. And one day, I resolved to write about one.
Why did you think they were voyeurs?
You have to spend hours and hours. You have to keep awake for as long as you can, staring at rows of letters or figures behind which the enemy is talking to the enemy, and it is a form of voyeurism. And, in many respects, Peeping Tom owes its birth to the extraordinary atmosphere in which we in SOE had to work. We were a very, very, very difficult body of people to know.
Each of the women in this movie who has been murdered has died with a horrified expression on her face. And the cops are wondering what they could possibly have seen that could account for this horrible expression, which is unlike the expression the cops have ever seen on corpses before. And we find out at the end that the reason why these women have this horrified expression on their faces when they die is that the filmmaker who's been filming them as he murders them has held up a mirror to them at the moment of their death. And so what they're seeing is the expression on their faces as he stabs them in the neck. And that's why they look so horrified, because they're watching their own murder. What a really weird thing to think of for a movie. How did you think of this? This is something that sticks with everybody who sees your film, I think.
Michael Powell.
The director of the film.
Yes, who was a genius. Michael Powell didn't know how this film ended. And when I went to tell it to him, neither did I. And there he was sitting with this camera face. And I was supposed to tell him how Peeping Tom was frightened to death. And he looked at me with these brilliant, obsessed camera eyes. And I was frightened myself. And suddenly realized how Peeping Tom would kill his victims. And Michael Powell accepted it at once.
The film has so much to say about a certain kind of behavioral psychology, about voyeurism through the media. I'm wondering if you were exposed to behavioral psychology as a kid, if anybody was kind of charting your fears in the way this character's father charted his.
My father's only fears were that I would not become a bookseller. My mother's only fear was that I might marry out of a religion.
Right.
Fundamentally, SOE is a pretty good breeding ground for phobia and fear of every single kind.
Sure.
The atmosphere in a briefing room is frightening to those who have to conduct the briefing. And a study of fear emerged naturally.
Now, another thing that drifts through Peeping Tom is pornography, because what this character does for a living is take girls in erotic poses, take pictures of them to be sold under the counter at a local store. And I'm wondering, in the days when you frequented your father's bookstore, which was an antiquarian bookstore, if there were old, rare, erotic or pornographic texts that you had access to?
Oh, yes. The pornography was on the fourth floor, not very far away from the rare religious books. The pornography was of a very high order, indeed, and only very distinguished people were allowed up there. A certain member of the royal family practically had his throne there. Anyway, yes, I was allowed to see it. And I feel sometimes Peeping Tom did not do justice to its potential. But in those days, we had a censor to compete with. And fundamentally, Peeping Tom himself, fundamentally, only learnt what love is when he died. And that in itself is pornography, to have to go to those extremes to feel properly.
We're listening to a 1999 interview with Leo Marx. He died in January. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to a 1999 interview with screenwriter and World War II code maker Leo Marx. He died in January. Martin Scorsese loves Peeping Tom. And I imagine that it was through Peeping Tom that he met you. He asked you to be the voice of Satan in his film The Last Temptation of Christ. And before I ask you about this, let's hear you as the voice of Satan. And you appear to Willem Dafoe, who's Christ in the film. Satan appears just as a flame, as a large flame, and you're the voice of the flame.
Archangel, move back. Move back, you're blinding me.
Jesus. I'm the one you've been waiting for. Remember, when you were a little boy, you cried, make me a god. God, God, make me a god.
But I was just a child then.
You are God. The Baptist knew it. Now it's time you admit it. You are his son, the only son of God.
Son of God.
Join me. Join me. Together we'll rule the living and the dead. You'll give life and you'll take life. You'll sit in judgment and I'll sit next to you. Imagine how strong we could be together.
Satan.
When Martin Scorsese asked you to be the voice of Satan, did he know that you were particularly interested in the occult in the days when you frequented your father's antiquarian bookstore?
I had a live answer phone at home, and he used to phone occasionally and talk, and suddenly had the idea, because I was coming to New York to see Helene Humph with my wife, perhaps you'd be the voice of Satan. When I read the script, I wished I were Satan because I found the lines unsayable. But not knowing very much about Satan's dialogue, having left SOE years before, I did what I could with it. And when that session was over, made the great mistake of saying to Martin Scorsese, whom I venerate, "What are you going to do professionally?" Which I hoped might get a laugh, but which I've yet to be forgiven. He is a genius, but I still believe the last temptation of Christ was one that should properly have been resisted.
The movie, you mean, making the movie?
I was the voice of the devil. I would like to be again, but not with that dialogue. No.
Do you enjoy going to bookstores now?
No.
Why?
Because 84 Charing Cross Road. I miss it.
Nothing measures up to that?
No. No, no. It was more than a bookshop. It was possible to see Charles Chaplin in one corner and J.B. Priestley in another, then Freud wandered in before he died, writing a book called Moses and Monotheism. And there was a prostitute right opposite the building who collected Rudyard Kipling and asked the manager to keep copies for her if it were a first edition, while she came back with the cash in about an hour. So it was a rich, rich, rich bookshop, full of unexpected qualities. I miss that prostitute. She was a very adventurous woman with an extraordinarily attractive puppy. And she did appreciate Rudyard Kipling.
Leo Marx, thank you so much.
Goodbye now.
Leo Marx, recorded in 1999. He died in January at the age of 80. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Chirac directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Strong Women Stay Young by Dr. Miriam Nelson, which describes her strength training program for women. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, an interview with Gladys Knight. She has a new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.